Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Mike Shackelford.
Mike, this is your first time here as a co-host. Getting nervous?
No, I'm pretty comfortable.
Oh, good. You've been here as a guest for, I think, three times.
Yes.
And good. We have a handshake deal that we're going to put up with each other for 6 months. I'm hoping that that deal isn't hard to keep for either one of us.
I'm hoping that too, and I'm excited to be here. I've been interviewed lots of times on the radio, but so this will be a good change to be doing the interviewing. And I do have a little experience. When I was back at UCSB, I had my radio show on KCSB.
University of California, Santa Barbara.
Yep, that's correct. Go Gauchos. And I had a radio show on the AM band there. So 25 years later, here I am doing it again.
Huh, you may have more experience than me. Okay. Our guest tonight is Jason Bean. He is a sports handicapper. We're going to be talking to him about the Super Bowl and some other things. And he's going to be on later, and although you may hear his voice at any time, no telling. Before we talk to Jason, though, I want to tell you something that happened last weekend. Max Rubin, who's been a guest on Gambling with an Edge twice, he's an expert at comp hustling. His book, Comp City, is required reading by all Advantage players. Max is also known for hosting the annual Blackjack Ball. The Blackjack Ball invites maybe 150 gifted players a year. There's some authors invited, like Stanford Wong, Arnold Snyder, and this last year, Edward Thorpe, who started Advantage Blackjack 50 years ago with his book called Beat the Dealer. Two gaming lawyers who have also been on our show, Bob Nersessian and Bob Loeb, were there, and as well as eight other people who've also been on the show. So I knew almost everybody there, which was interesting, and I got to be there, which is exciting for me. Part of the invitation is you're requested, which I don't know what requested means exactly, but you're requested to bring a bottle of chilled premium champagne, preferably comped. It wasn't easy for me to score a comp bottle of Dom Perignon, but it did. Mike, did you bring a bottle of champagne?
You know, I discreetly forgot to this year.
Oh, okay. We'll hope Max didn't hear this or didn't notice. So when I brought my bottle, Max was at the door checking to see it. He looked at the Dom. He approved, and he said the magic words, "I trust this was comped," and I knew the right answer, and that was, of course it was comped. I learned from the compmeister. So anyway, can you tell I want to be invited again next year? At the end of every ball is a 21-question Calcutta. A 21-question challenge. This is their 21 impossible questions. But before the challenge, there's a Calcutta, which is betting. You bet on who's going to win. And one guy bets 500, somebody else bets 600, 700, whatever it goes up to. The money's all given back to whoever owns the players. Now, it's 40% for first, 30% for second, 20 for third, 10 for fourth, I think. The best player there, James Grosjean, has won the challenge three times. He's disqualified from ever entering again. But his name's on the cup. It's the James Grosjean Trophy. There's one guy who's won twice and been in the finals two or three other times. He got the most money bet on him in the Calcutta, which is appropriate. You may have heard of him. His name is Richard Munchkin. He was my co-host until last week. The winner last year was also here. You may have heard of him. His name is Michael Shackelford. Now, Mike and I were in the same betting group in the Calcutta, along with some other people. That betting group won some money, but not because of Mike or me, unfortunately. But somebody else carried the ball. Bets went down. We all took the test. And none of the names I've mentioned so far placed. Although James Grosstein took the test, calling himself Alex Y, and scored well enough to make the finals. But when Max Rubin discovered who Alex Y was, he disqualified James, which James knew he would. But he had to prove he was still the best. One name got the finals, and he's already announced on his website that he ended up second place. You've heard of him. He's Anthony Curtis, publisher of the Las Vegas Advisor. Now, the other three people in the finals, I'm not going to mention by name because they may not want to be outed on the air. But Anthony has already announced that he came in second, and plus he's a good friend of both Mike and me, so Anthony is fair game. In the finals, they have a blackjack skills test. This reveals all kinds of things that could be useful when you're playing blackjack. The interesting story is in something called card sequencing. The way this works, they spread out a deck of cards, and you need to memorize the first 12 cards that are there in order, just by rank. In other words, 3, queen, king, ace, 7. You don't care if it's hearts, spades, clubs, or diamonds, just the rank. And you go around until somebody misses. And the reason they do this is if you have memorized a sequence and the shuffle is predictable, then you know what card is coming, and this can give you a big advantage. This is a totally separate skill from card counting. So when the card sequencing test came around, there are only 3 players left, Anthony and 2 other guys. The 30 seconds for memorizing, Max Rubin, who was dealing, turned the deck over. Doesn't shuffle. Player one predicts a 3 is first. Max turns over 3. Player two says an 8 is next. Max turns over an 8. Now it's Anthony's turn, position 3, and he correctly announces that a jack is next. Round two, back to player one, player two, and Anthony again. All of them get the correct. The next round is where was the critical round, where the adventure happened. Player 1 called an 8. There was an 8. Now, before player 2 could speak up, Anthony loudly announces that a 5 was coming next. Now, it wasn't Anthony's turn. So, anything Anthony said doesn't count. Now, player 2, I'm looking at him. I'm standing right next to Max, so I have a good view of this. And he's looking confused. He doesn't think a 5 is coming next. But Anthony's... he's done well in these tests before. So he decides to trust Anthony's memory better than his own memory. So he says, okay, 5. Max turns over a 10. Anthony shrugs. The guy is disqualified. Max gives Anthony a really dirty look. Now, I don't know what this dirty look means. It could be he was pissed at Anthony for messing up the contest. It also could be that he thought Anthony pulled a fast one, and that was pretty good. So, but anyway, Max. So now Anthony's turn. He says 5. Max turns over a 5. The next round, Anthony falters, so the other guy wins. So player 1 won this round. Anthony came in second. Player 3, this guy originally player 2, ended up third. There were some contests after this, but that was the ending result of the contest. So afterwards, I go up to Anthony and ask him whether his speaking out of turn was an accident or whether he did it on purpose just to mess up player 2. Anthony takes another sip of champagne, grins broadly, and says, "You'll never know for sure because I'm not going to tell you." Personally, my best guess is that in the heat of the competition, Anthony got a little confused as to who was going to go next, and he didn't screw up on purpose. That's just my guess. but I'll never know for sure.
That's my theory, too. I played against Anthony last year. He came in second to me, and I felt that he played a clean game that year. There was some controversy between him and one of the other players, and I didn't understand what it was about, but I felt that Anthony felt that he was tricked or something like that, and he seemed very visibly angry about something, and I've never had the chance to ask him about it, but maybe he was turning the... But no, I think that... I agree with you. I think that he just spoke out of turn.
Yeah, it could happen.
And he didn't want to...
Was there a card sequencing test in the year you won?
Yes, there was, and I did well at it.
Well, good. Do you practice that? Now, I'm assuming in a card sequencing test that you memorize four cards at a time. So, like, if you're going to try to remember 12, you remember three sets of four rather than 12 sets of one. Is that the way you do it?
This is an advantage play. I never got in, so I just had to completely wing that. But I probably just looked for patterns of numbers that seemed similar to each other, and put them into groups, and tried to remember it that way.
And however you did it, it worked.
Yes.
Well, good. Don't knock success. All right. So why don't you tell us about Jason Bean?
Yes, Jason Bean is our guest today. Jason has worked with Las Vegas Sports Consultants, which is a handicapping service, and Leroy's for 17 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, since, right after I got out of college.
Uh-huh, and Jason was one of the first people I met when I moved to Vegas 11 years ago. I've had many dinners with him, played golf with him. I know Jason well. He took care of my dog when I went to Hawaii last year. And so Jason's a good friend of mine.
But he's wearing his hat backwards. That makes him a poker player, doesn't it?
Jason plays poker, too.
I play poker from time to time. Once in a while.
But I wanted Jason on this show because it's going to be the Super Bowl this weekend. And Jason's main area of expertise is in sports betting, although he also plays poker. So, Jason, welcome to Gambling with an
Thanks,
Edge.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
Okay. Let's start out with the most important questions. Who do you like against the spread and the total?
I think there's value, actually, with the Patriots. I know that the Giants did, they're the hot team, and that's what everyone seems to be betting on, in recent years. The Packers last year got hot. Pittsburgh a couple years ago. But I made the game actually 4.5, not for a market price, but just for power rating purposes. So I think there's a couple points of value with the Patriots.
So now it's about 2.5 or 3?
2.5 or 3 around town. My gut feeling says it's going to be 3 when the game starts everywhere.
Yeah, Patriots -3 even money is the going line right now, right?
Yeah, I've seen a couple 2.5s at some places. As of this morning, I believe it's 3.
The South Point casinos, I believe, have -2.5, -110.
Yeah, I've seen... They've been booking that game in a very risky way. I mean, they've been going from 2.5 to 3 a couple times a day, it seems like. So they're taking a stand on it. They don't want to move the money line on 3. So if the game ends 3, I don't think they're gonna like it much. But that's an aggressive way of booking, and I compliment them for it.
So will you take a stand that New England -2.5, -110 is a good bet?
It's a good bet, in my opinion. What might even be better is right near game time, you could find a really, really cheap money line on the Patriots. There's been a trend in Super Bowls where the money line on the favorite's much cheaper mathematically than it should be. So it's probably
if the fair line is 3, what should the money line be?
Right around -155, -160. The lay price, the mid price should be about $1.40. 55-35, -155 on the favorite, +135 on the underdog. But with the Super Bowl, it's a dynamic where the public likes to take the underdog on the money line, regardless of price, it seems like. So, with 2.5, if you could find -125 somewhere right before the game, that's better than laying 2.5, in my opinion.
I'm hoping to find Patriots money line -130, but I think the best right now is -135.
That's the best I've seen is 135, correct?
Yep. How about the total? The total is 55. What do you think?
I've noticed it's moved down maybe a point, 1.5. It's funny, when they played in the regular season, it was 0-0 at halftime. So, but it ended 24-20. I think the total will probably go over. I mean, I don't think it's a really good bet or anything. I just think it'll be a higher scoring game. The Patriots' defense is not particularly good. And Tom Brady, I mean, you know, he's arguably the best quarterback in football. You should dissect, you know, a weak Giants secondary if he can avoid being sacked. I mean,
and Eli has made a lot of comebacks this year. So.
He certainly has. I'm a Packers fan. I was at the game 2 weeks ago, and it was a long day. So he had a really good day. The whole team did. They're playing as well as anybody right now. They're the hot team. But I just think the Patriots are better overall.
Now, do you think that the over is good enough to lay 110 for?
No. I would just think that the totals, just my opinion, is it's going to go over. I'm certainly not going to bet on it. I think it'll be a higher scoring game, somewhere, you know, like 31-28, that kind of score.
So you told us a little bit about your reasons, but can you elaborate about how you set a line or a total for a game? You know, if I were doing it, it would be very mathematical.
Right.
But it seems to me like you can just pull a line out of thin air.
Math is not my, you know, strongest suit as far as setting line. You're just trying to, when I worked for Las Vegas sports consultants, you're just trying to get a number that's going to get equal action on both sides. I have two different numbers, one that I'd make a game for betting purposes, one for setting a market. For example, like with the Super Bowl, I had the Patriots about 4.5. But you couldn't possibly send that line out if you're looking for even action on both sides. So for market setting purposes, 3 would be about right. But for my ratings, it would indicate a bet on the Patriots just for a point and a half, 2 points of value, in my opinion.
So speaking of handicapping, do you handicap sports besides football?
Yeah, baseball, golf. The only sport I don't handicap is basketball. It's just, there's too many points.
Oh, good. What's the line on Trinity squash? No, sorry. A month and a half ago, Giants had a 7-7 record. They were real long shots to make the to win the Super Bowl.
That's
so
correct.
You could find lines, I don't know, 60-1, 80-1, something big.
Yeah, I mean, they needed, you know, to win out basically their last 3 or 4 games. They needed about 2 or 3 other teams to lose a lot. Just for them to make the playoffs was a high long shot in about week 14 or 15.
And then they had to beat the Packers, who were widely considered to be the best team,
yeah, I mean,
best
they were,
team in football.
Yes, I mean, they were 15-1 in the regular season. They had to go into Green Bay and beat them, and they did that.
Jason so, was at that game.
I was there, unfortunately.
I see you're still crying. Good.
Now, pretty much.
Okay, so the casinos booked a lot of that money at 60-1 or 80-1, whatever that number was. And if the Giants win this weekend, that's part of the bet. It's going to be really expensive for casinos.
Yeah.
So how do the casinos adjust other lines to make up for this?
What you would do is you would do whatever you could to encourage betting on the Patriots. You would be lower than the market with the point spread and the money line. You just want to balance off that action somehow, where you're taking large bets on the. You're trying to induce large bets on the Patriots to offset, basically on the money line. You want the Patriots bet, so you're trying to offset that risk in your future book.
So instead of the fair line at 4.5, you make it 3.
Well, not so much with the points. I mean, you would want to encourage the point spread a little bit. Let's say the market's 3 everywhere. You might want to be 2.5 minus 115 or something. You don't want to give away the house on it. But where you would want to be better than the rest of the market is on the money line. With, let's say you have a $100,000 risk with the Giants winning the Super Bowl. You would want to be much lower if you're trying, you know, to offset that possible loss with the Giants winning the Super Bowl. You'd want to be maybe minus 120 or minus 125 on the money line just to balance that book out.
Okay. So I know props are not your thing. They're my thing. But
right.
Do you have any prop tips you can share anyway?
What I do with props is I just look at I analyze how I think the game's going to go. And let's say I think it's going to be the Patriots in a high-scoring game. I'll look for certain props like Tom Brady over a certain amount of touchdown passes, things like that, where maybe mathematically it comes out where the line is a little too high on it. I might take it at the very end where, you know, I mean, let's say his total touchdown passes, for example, opens up 2.5 over -130, and mathematically it's too high. Sharp bettors that are in, you know, analyze it mathematically and are really good prop bettors would bet it under. Right when the game starts, I might take it over at a really good price. But that's how I would look at props. I like to look at
it's the more seat of the pants for you rather than
right. I like to look at the multi-sport ones too. Where I mean, there was a place up in Lake Tahoe. They stopped this about 7 or 8 years ago. They'd have
related to how many points Kobe Bryant scores.
Like that, exactly. They would actually do it. Like one year they had total points in the game against Mark McGwire home runs, for example. This was 1999 or something. And those things are a lot easier to figure than sometimes those lines were made too high with they weren't basically giving enough credit to the home run hitter in that particular prop.
Okay, speaking of props, here's a question I have for you. Two of my favorite props during the regular season are first score to be a touchdown and under 3.5 field goals. And this season, I just got killed on these two props.
Right, right.
And I did some analysis. Prior to this season, the average number of field goals per game is 2.98. However, this year, during the regular season, it was 3.27. So what explains this glut of field goals this year?
I think basically better quarterback play from top to bottom, getting the team in field goal range a lot more often. If you were to look at the total scores this year, I haven't done the analysis for the whole year, but I mean there's been a lot more totals way up there in the 50s than ever before. So obviously with a higher total, that's going to increase field goals a little bit. Better kickers too. I mean, there's
rule changes about hitting defenseless players
it's become an offensive game now. I mean, with the new labor rule, you can only have padded practices, I believe, once or twice a week, or not even that much, I think. So it's become more of a finesse sport than it has hard hitting. If you touch a quarterback, that's going to be 15 yards. Players are more careful about that now. It's become just an offensive league with a lot more finesse and a lot less hard hitting.
So I know they have to kick off from further ahead now.
Do you think that would actually help lower field goals. So, I mean, because most of the time there's a lot of possessions starting at the 20-yard line as opposed to the past where, say, average starting position might be the 27, 28-yard line. So that part I'm not really sure if that has much of an effect. It should have an effect, but it obviously hasn't, judging by the stats you just told me.
I've asked this question to other people, and the most common answer I get is that field goal kickers are just a lot better now.
Absolutely.
10 years ago, the point at which there was like a 50-50 chance might have been maybe around the 45-yard line, would you say?
It's more than that. I mean, I was at a Packers game in Atlanta earlier this year, and I got there for warm-ups. I was watching the Packers kicker. He was nailing them from 65 yards, no problem, in warm-ups. Obviously, there's no, attempt at a block in those kicks. But, I mean, these kickers are just incredible now compared to what they were 10, 15 years ago. Also, there's a lot more fields that are not grass. There's a lot more field turf, which makes it easier for kickers. They're not going to lose their footing a lot more. Mm-hmm. So it's just little things like that basically add into the fact that there's been more field goals. But overall, the kicking's much better. There's a lot more specialty schools for kickers at young ages now.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there
you can go to a kicker school in Miami or something?
There's kicking and punting schools all over. I mean, with the money players are getting in the NFL now, these kids started at young ages just – for special teams work on kicking and punting.
Had no idea.
Yeah.
Now, I watch the game sometimes, and sometimes in like the end of the first half, with 2 minutes and 10 seconds to go, teams will call a timeout. To me, that seems silly because they're only gaining 10 seconds worth of stoppage.
I couldn't agree more with that.
But if they score at 1:58 or after the 2 minute warning, then they save a lot of time. Now, do you notice the coaches who do this, and like in your mind, put, well, this guy's an idiot, yes, so I'm going to do an extra half point against him and things like that.
It is amazing how awful most NFL coaches are in game management. These guys are brilliant drawing up plays, setting up defenses, but when it comes to using the clock, they're just, I mean, I've seen it. I saw an example this year where there was about a minute and a half left. They had two timeouts, and it was a tie game, and the other team had the ball at the 10-yard line. Basically, they're going to score. And he let the clock run all the way down to 6 seconds without using any of his timeouts. And they just kicked an extra point to win the game. I mean, you would want to use your timeouts immediately to give yourself a chance to win the game. But it's just puzzling how some of these coaches manage games.
Yeah, Jason Garrett didn't score points for clock management this year for the Cowboys.
There's a perfect example. I think they were playing Washington where he just...
What about things such as fourth and goal from the 1 yard line? It used to be they always kicked the field goal.
In this day and age,
Belichick always goes for it.
As well he should. I mean, everyone's still giving him a lot of, crap about going. There was a playoff game against the Colts. Exactly. And it was fourth and two at the 38, I believe. They get 2 yards, they go to the Super Bowl, or I forgot if it was a championship game or a divisional.
It was against
playoffs.
The Colts, so it would be a divisional game.
Right. If they pick up 2 yards, the game's over. You go for it there. You don't. I mean, you're better off being aggressive. You don't want Peyton Manning coming back on the field to beat you. That's certainly the way to go. Coaches aren't aggressive enough.
And it didn't work, and he...
Right. It happened with the Falcons this year, too, with... In overtime, they went for it on fourth and inches from their own 29-yard line. Didn't get it, and the Saints kicked a field goal to win.
So you notice which coaches are good and which coaches are bad at that, and you adjust your betting because of that?
I don't know so much adjusting the betting because it doesn't happen every game. It's kind of more randomness. But game management does play a role. I mean, I like to yell at the TV a lot at, what's going on with these guys.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sure you're alone in that. Nobody else likes to yell at the TV.
Yeah, my amateur opinion is that these coaches don't consider the mathematics and the probabilities involved when making a decision like, should I punt or go for it on fourth and short? And I think that the odds, as you said, would favor going for it on fourth and short most
Without
of the time.
Question. I mean, unless you're at your 1 yard line or something, mm-hmm. your own 1 yard line, it's just, I mean, but, let's say you're near midfield, you should be going for it on fourth and one almost every time.
Amen. Okay, let me change the topic a little. One of your specialties is how the weather affects sports. And a common thing that I hear is that if it's going to be really cold, to bet the under. Can you speak to that?
I think that's not a very good cold weather. The only thing that is going to affect a football game is wind. It can be snowing. It can be raining. I mean, I'm talking NFL now, where field conditions are going to be good no matter what. I mean, the NFL has standards.
Unless you're playing in Philadelphia,
right? Yeah, they have. The last bad field I remember in the NFL was Pittsburgh had one in opening day against the Dolphins, like 4 or 5 years ago. There were a couple Cowboys games when they played in Mexico. The field was horrible, but. Other than that, I mean, field conditions are generally going to be good in the NFL, but rain and snow, people like to bet unders. That's false. I mean, there's really, really good value at the end when people are doing that, betting the over.
That's very interesting.
Crosswinds in football are killers. I mean, that you can't adjust a total enough with a strong crosswind. It's going to be very, very hard to pass.
Can you predict when a crosswind is going to be happening?
Mm-hmm. You can. I look at... The best weather place to look, weather.com's garbage, Intellicast isn't very... You got to go to the National Weather Service and actually read what's called a tabular forecast, where they narrow it down to what it'll be like during game time, not during the whole day. And, I mean, if it's going to be real windy at night, that's not going to help you during the game. You got to know what the forecast is for the game.
But they're not going to tell you which direction the wind's coming from and relative to the field.
Well, yeah, they will.
Really?
I mean, it'll say west. Over 80% of football stadiums' end zones are north-south in direction. So you're looking for strong easterly and westerly winds that will, if you see that, you're going to generally, I mean, obviously you have to make sure it's a north-south end zone stadium, but it's going to be a much lower scoring game.
That's very interesting. How about the weather in baseball?
Baseball, it's ballpark dependent. I mean, like Wrigley Field in Chicago, the wind conditions there are, everyone knows what they are. If it's from the northeast, it's blowing straight in, southwest straight out. There's certain stadiums like Texas, for example, if you were to look at the forecast, it'll say winds blowing in from right. But in that particular stadium, that means there's such a jet effect there, it's actually blowing out to right center. So there's certain stadiums like...
In from right, but out to right center.
Yeah, there's... The wind in Texas is primarily from the south during...
I thought of the wind from Texas from the politicians.
That's true, too. But okay. If it's coming in from right there, it's really blowing out to right center. So it's key things like that you got to look at. But if you were to just follow Wrigley Field's wind, generally betting the opposite of what... Let's say, you know, the wind's blowing straight out and the over-under is 13 or 12 and a half, you'll make money betting the under as opposed to following betting on what the wind is doing there.
Okay.
Now, this is Mike's list that I saw, and I find it intriguing. So the 1945 GOAT hoax, what is that all about?
With the Cubs, yeah. There was a guy, the Cubs hadn't, I believe, I could be wrong on this, it was 1906 or 1908 the last time they won the World Series, but... the 1945 World Series, I think they were playing the Yankees. Some owner of a restaurant in Chicago had a goat, like as a mascot or something for his restaurant. It was the Billy Goat Tavern or restaurant. And he wanted to bring the goat to the game with him. And the Cubs said, you can't bring this goat into Wrigley Field. You know, you can't have him here during the game. And the guy basically told the Cubs, you're never going to win the World Series ever again. And that pretty much is the curse. Since then, they certainly haven't.
So they came close in 2003.
But the goat's long gone by 2003. If that goat was there in 19, I don't know how long goats live.
I guess
but it's
when
not
you don't
long.
Win for almost 100 years, the legend grows year by year.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be just a little thing back in 1945. But when it gets to be, you know, almost 70 years later, I guess the coast of the. The curse of the Billy Goat continues to grow.
So they mention this story in the book Sportscasting, which is an outstanding book.
Yes.
It's all about, it's like a Freakonomics of sports. It attempts to debunk lots of commonly held beliefs or what they would call myths about sports betting.
Yeah.
And they, one question they bring up is, why are the Chicago Cubs so bad? And they mention this as the myth, and then they attempt to explain their theory of it. But would you care to address that?
Well, part of it, in my opinion, is just they play until 1988, Wrigley Field didn't have lights. So they were the only team that would play all 81 home games in the afternoon. And I think that it took a more of a wear and tear on the players than people thought.
Playing in the daytime?
Playing in the daytime
harder than nighttime?
Every day. It just,
is it because it's hot?
Not so much that. It's just, I mean, when you're on the road, you're playing night games every day. And when you're at home, you know, it's just, it became tougher. I think the wear and tear over 162 games is tough enough. Having to play every afternoon at home, that's part of it. I mean, certainly not all of it. They just, first of all, they've never had good teams. I mean, other than a couple good players, you know, Ryan Sandberg in the 80s, Ernie Banks, Ron Santo. I mean, they're just... not good compared to their competition.
They have money to pay for it. I mean, Chicago's a major city.
They just rely on fans. Fans are going to go to Wrigley Field because it's a landmark to begin with. So why spend the money on players when you can pretty much guarantee you're going to have 30,000 out there every day?
What's your theory, Mike?
Well, the sports casting theory, I can't claim it for my own, is throughout the whole book, it keeps making the point about how money affects sports. And in this case, they say that the Chicago Cubs fans are the most loyal in baseball.
That is
true. They will show up no matter how good or bad the team is. And they also point to the fact that the Chicago Cubs stadium has the cheapest beer in Major League Baseball. And they say that a lot of the fans go there just for the beer. But because these fans are so loyal and support their team win or lose, they're not getting any additional revenue from tickets if they perform well.
Very
so the
true.
Team is not incentivized to spend money on good players.
That's very true. I mean, they have a new owner now, and we'll see how he, you know, operates. But You know, Wrigley's adding in an electronic scoreboard for the first time this year. They're still not getting rid of the one in center field, but it's a digital board in right field now. When the weather's warm in the summer there, it's going to be sold out almost every game. It's just people like to spend time there. They don't really, you know, that's why the Cubs are the lovable losers. They show up, they enjoy the game, and if they win, great. If not, we'll be back tomorrow.
Before I moved to Vegas, I lived in Los Angeles, and the Lakers have, in my lifetime, have generally been an excellent team.
Right.
And the Clippers have been awful. This year, the Clippers have some players, and they're currently ahead of the Lakers at this moment.
Wow.
And so the question is, do they have a chance to win? My thought is that if you put the Clippers players in Lakers uniforms, they would do better because Laker management is so much better.
Yeah,
but,
I mean,
but I don't know. Are the Clippers going to beat the Lakers this year? Do you have any clue?
I would probably. My guess is as good as yours on this.
The answer is no.
The ownership between the two teams is light and day. I mean, you know, Jerry Buss will get the best available players. Donald Sterling, I think, is still with the Clippers. I don't think. They do have a lot of talent now, though. So.
Yes, they do. They have a guy who leaps over cars.
That's right. That's right. The guy from Oklahoma, I believe.
Okay, here's another question that comes up from sportscasting. Is they devote a lot of the book to answering the question of why do the home teams have the advantage in every single sport? What's your theory on that?
Well, I mean, traveling's a tough thing for any team. So that's a natural advantage for the home team to begin with. Having the, especially in football, crowd noise is a major factor. I mean, when you're trying to call audibles in, you know, the quarterback and he can't, and the receivers and linemen can't hear, there's going to be a lot more false start penalties, things like that. So there's a natural advantage for the home team in crowd behavior, exactly. In the NFL, there's like about 2.5 or 3 points added to the home team in the spread anyway. So when you're betting it, there's really no – you're not getting much value that way. But overall, I mean, the home team's always going to have an advantage. It's not going to be huge in sports like baseball or hockey. Or basketball maybe a little more than those two sports I just mentioned. But having the crowd behind you certainly is a psychological edge, and that's always going to help.
So the sportcasting took a totally different point of view, didn't it?
Yes, it does say that traveling does have something to do with it, and when you have to travel to a game and then play it the same day or the next day, you're definitely at a disadvantage. And the book kind of poo-poos the crowd effect.
Mm-hmm.
They say that the main reason for the home field advantage is the referees, and they say that referees in every sport favor the home team. For example,
I think that's true to a certain extent. Yeah,
and you might ask why these referees are supposed to be impartial.
Why then?
They don't like to be booed and cussed at by the fans, I guess. But I mean,
that might be it. They like to be liked.
That's. I think that if the writers of that book were here, they would say yes. But ultimately, they say that it comes down to money. Is they want the fans to leave happy, and the fans are mostly supporting the home team, and maybe it's.
I think that's more the case in the NBA than other sports. I mean, an umpire in baseball is going to have the same strike zone pretty much every day. I mean, it might be an inch better for the home team sometimes, but
an inch can be a lot.
Yeah, the book has all kinds of diagrams of strike zones.
Right.
Trying to make their point that the zones are different and that the home team enjoys a bigger strike zone.
That's generally the case. I mean, it's more I believe in the NFL, I mean, like if you were to watch the Packers-Giants game, playoff game a couple of weeks ago, they got a lot of questionable calls to go their way at home. So it happens a lot in the NFL too, more so in the NFL and basketball and NBA. I think personally the NBA is kind of crooked as far as the refs. I think the commissioner sets it up for the big market teams, but that's kind of been proven a couple times with Lakers.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have for our interview. Thank you very much. That was very interesting.
It was.
Okay, Mike.
Hope we have you back again.
Anytime.
We talk maybe with a baseball bend or something like that. That would
be good.
Yeah,
with the Masters Golf Tournament coming up, that's one of my specialties, too. So.
Really?
Yeah.
No. Well, good.
In April.
Is Tiger going to win this year?
No. I don't think so.
All right. Very good. All right. So thank you. And Michael, usually when Richard was sitting in your chair, right after the guest finished, I'd ask Richard, what did we learn today? And so today I'm going to ask myself that because Jason and you're both in that area more than I am. So my question is, what did I learn today from Jason? And part of it was there are a lot of different ways to handicap. I've been exposed to you, Michael, and you're a walking slide rule. And so everything is by the numbers. And Jason is more of a seat of the pants guy. And they both can be successful. And sometimes you're going to come up with the same answer, and sometimes you don't. But that came clear, loud and clear today.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not news at all to you, is it?
Yeah, no, Jason always likes to, he's good at pulling a line on anything. And much like me, he will bet on anything. And we will bet on all kinds of silly stuff when we're out in a restaurant or a casino.
Which raindrop reached the bottom of the, a lot of politics?
Yeah, we have some politics bets.
I mean, like dollar bets or these big ones?
You could say that, yeah.
I mean,
but they're you know, in the low thousands.
Oh, okay, good. So that's you want to take them seriously. So although dollar bets could be that way. So Michael, you have the Wizard of Odds website and a couple others. Now, in general, what's happening on your websites?
Okay, well, the Wizard of Odds is always the star of the show. That's where I put most of my attention. But the last 2 years, I've devoted a lot of time and money towards my latest site, wizardofvegas.com. The emphasis of that is all things Vegas, whether it's gambling related, restaurants, shows. I have lots of articles. I review probably about 75% of the properties in Vegas. There is a forum on Wizard of Vegas, unlike Wizard of Odds, and there's always lively conversations going on about all kinds of things. We try to keep it emphasized around math and specifically game strategy, but you never know what'll come up, and all points of view are welcome. There's always lively discussions about religion and all kinds of stuff. You know, I also have my website, Wizard of Macau. I must admit that one's getting a little dusty, and I'm overdue to go back and add some more material to that. And this year, I'm hoping to introduce a new website, which is going to be gambling advice in Spanish.
So how do you say Wizard of Odds in Spanish?
You would say, well, wizard is mago.
Mago?
There is no good word in Spanish for just odds. You could say probabilidades for probabilities, but that's a real mouthful. The word for bet is apuesto. So I might call it El Mago de los Apuestos.
Huh.
I still haven't firmly decided on a name yet.
That was a very serious answer to a smart-ass question. You did well. Let me talk a little bit about the South Point. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. In February, there will be three double point days, Valentine's Day, President's Day, and February 29th, which they're calling Leap Year Day. Monday through Friday of next week, if you earn 3,000 points on video poker or 1,000 on slots, you get a logo South Point jacket. They have free online poker at southpointpoker.com every month. $100,000 in cash and prizes is given away, including a seat at next year's World Series of Poker main event. This coming Wednesday's free video poker class is Advanced NSU Deuces Wild. To have a decent shot at understanding what we're talking about, you need to be very familiar with regular NSU Deuces Wild, preferably already having taken the basic class from me. If you don't know what an advanced class would consist of, let me give you an example. Consider a hand starting with deuce, 7, 8, 9, totally unsuited, and the fifth card is a 4. From that starting position, 75% of the time you hold the deuce, 7, 8, 9, and 25% of the time you just hold the deuce. It's not a penalty card situation. It's actually the opposite of penalty card situation. Now, these kind of things fascinate me, and they drive other people up the wall. So depending on your point of view, if you're fascinated like me, next Wednesday at noon, come on by. We're in the South Point and the showroom. If you are, if that kind of thing bugs you up the wall, you're not going to like the class. At the Palms introduced a senior program in January called Sterling Advantage for players 50 years of age and older. Every month, the prize package was a little bit different. February includes a Thursday slot tournament. There's going to be $7,500 in prizes in the tournament and another $2,500 in drawings. Play, earn, and win, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, for the first part of the month, has a Valentine's Day theme. The top prize include a $100 gift certificate for Edible Arrangements, which is they make bouquets of chocolate-covered strawberries and things like that. They also have a Kindle Touch. I'm not sure why that's Valentine's theme, but Shirley tells me she wants a Kindle's Touch, so I got one for her. Both these require 2,500 points apiece. You get to keep them. If you assume it's $100 face value, then that's 0.40 additional. So it's more than double points, but it's less than triple points. Throughout February, they're having a promotion for blackjack. They're calling it Blackjack Bingo. Unlike regular bingo, they have 10 squares on it. Completing the card is worth $350 in promotional chips. Now, I just showed it to Michael 5 minutes before we got on the air, and he said he'll look at it and he'll do a little bit of analysis and tell us more about it next week. Some of the bingo squares are easy, like getting a black suited natural, which is going to happen every, I don't know, 160, 170 hands, something like that. And some are like a suited 777, which in round numbers is impossible. So Mike's going to look at that and see what it is. I have figured out that whatever the price is, whatever the odds are, it adds, if you're betting $15, you only get half as much percentage-wise if you're betting $30. So that much I figured out. So next week, our guest is going to be Josh Axelrod. Josh is a graduate of Columbia, which is Ivy League school. He played on a blackjack card counting team. And after the MIT team, they did use a big player. He wrote a book called Repeat Until Rich. I kind of wish I had thought of that, because that's kind of my approach to gambling, is to keep doing what I'm doing and just hope the money keeps rolling in. So I've read the book. Michael, have you read it yet?
I'm about halfway through, and I thought it was pronounced Axelrad.
It could be. Could be. It's R-A-D. So one of the things we're going to ask about is when he was in the casino, he wore dreadlocks, which is like they were in Haiti. And so most blackjack counters try to disguise themselves and fit in like everybody else. And walking through a casino wearing dreads ain't much of a disguise. So we're going to ask him about that. And that's going to be next week. There have been, recently, there have been some really high-stakes poker buy-in events. Now, 2 weeks ago on the show, we talked to Daniel Negreanu about the $1 million buy-in event at next year's World Series of Poker that he was entering. He thought he had an advantage at it. And just last week, there was a $250,000 buy-in in Australia, won by Phil Ivey. Like 12 people in it, and he, like, the first prize was $2 million or something like that. So I'm surprised they keep having these over and over again. Michael, have you thought much about this?
I have some skepticism about the legitimacy of these. I don't know anything for sure, but professional gamblers hate volatility. And I think at the top level, all these poker players are roughly equally as good. So why would they go into a zero equity poker tournament? And I speculate that maybe they are splitting up the money after the fact behind the scenes, and it's more so for selling ads on the show and more fame for the poker players.
The World Series one, the $1 million one, I've heard it nicknamed the Buy a Bracelet Tournament.
Yeah, the Buy a Bracelet.
And I think by the number of bracelets you have, the sponsorship deals increase.
So. Well, that's true. It is easier beating 12 people right. or 20 than it is to beat 3,000. Another reason, I think, is Phil Ivey got $2 million for first place, and that goes in his lifetime tournament wins, which moves him from, like, fourth place to second place. So these guys kind of, like, put notches in their belt as to where they are in this lifetime earnings. The lifetime earnings does not consider how much the buy-in was.
True.
So if you want to go up to the lifetime earnings, you got to enter these. And for a lot of these players, they have sponsors. Like
very true.
Negrano is part of PokerStars, so I don't know what percentage of the money he puts up himself, but it ain't all of it, that's for sure. And if he wins, then his sponsorship deal increases.
Exactly.
Very good. So, Michael, we got 2 minutes left. This is the end of your first show. How do you think we did? Or how do you think you did, or something like that?
I thought it was a good show. And can I ask a question with these 2 minutes? I wasn't going to ask this. But there's this tune that has been bouncing around my head for days, and I don't know where it's from.
Okay.
I think it's like from a game show from the 70s or something. It goes like this. Da-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da. Do you guys know where that's from? This is driving me nuts.
All right. We have... If you know that, gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Michael will give you personally $1 million if you answer this question. Is that right, Michael?
How about an autographed copy of my book?
Ah, your book is called?
Gambling 102.
Well, that's got to be worth at least $1 million. Good. All right. So you want give it one more chance at it, and then the first person in email gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com gets an autographed copy of the book.
You got it. Thanks.
And give it. Give us that tune again in case they missed it.
Da 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 da.
All right. So Jason is looking like he doesn't think you should quit your day job, Mike.
Certainly, your singing career just ended.
I think that has about as much chance as my career as a Chippendales dancer.
Ah. Oh well. Good. So we're looking at our producer. How much time do we have? Give me an idea. Like less than a minute. Okay, good. So we're going to have in a few weeks, we don't exactly know when, an interview with BJ Traveler. He is this Chinese blackjack player. He goes all over the world. I think he's been in 66 countries. So we've actually already taped the interview, and we need to find a spot to run it. But when we do run that, it's very interesting. He has lots of interesting things to say.
Yeah, that was a great interview, and you'll all enjoy it.
Good. It was a great interview that it will be in the future. That's interesting tense. But anyway, hope you go out and hit lots of royal flushes, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.